record. I'm not sure why, but this program doesn't announce when it's recording, but I just set it up. Okay, so last week was somewhat radical because we were given the description of the creation of the world. But this week is even more radical because here we see something astonishing, which is, what do we find out in Parashat Noah? What do we learn that is absolutely breathtaking? There's not one single answer to that. What strikes you as astonishing?
The destruction of
willing to destroy the world.
It's astonishing that you said that God is willing to destroy the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And you find that astonishing morally, theologically? What do you find astonishing about that?
You just learned that he created it.
Right.
How is destroyed?
So I think there are a couple of components here. I think instinctively, morally, it's astonishing that God's willing to wipe out creation. It seems severe, over the top, intense, the kind of thing where one is in discipline and then instantly regrets, saying, I think I've gone too far, but I can't really lose faith at this point. It seems astonishing morally. That's certainly the case. And I think what we take for granted, because we're so familiar with these texts and these tales, is that theologically, God has regrets. God didn't know this would happen, didn't know this could happen. God forged a cosmos. The very last psukim of last week's parsha said, and God regretted that he made man. In the very second parsha, in the sixth and seventh chapter, God makes an admission. He made a mistake. People often make jokes about Adam and Eve, saying God created Eve because he realized the first copy wasn't that good, so he had to make a second attempt. But obviously that's said in jest. But here we have a real confession from God of regret. Why on earth would God, all-powerful, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, make a confession now that he made a mistake? If I were God and I were writing this, I think I would try to avoid episodes that make me look bad. And while, of course, humanity doesn't come out clean here, they are vile and vicious to each other. God didn't see that coming. God unleashed a world and then regretted it and made changes. It's astonishing. And I, on some level, fundamentally, it seems to me that following Adam and Eve's sin at the beginning of last week's parsha, in the middle of last week's parsha, and while, of course, Noah is about the destruction and the ruin that man and woman can wreak on the cosmos, there is a pivot point where God confesses that he makes mistakes too. And while it comes in the context of a deluge that wipes out most of humankind, so it's often lost, there is a slight insinuation that we all make mistakes, that God makes mistakes, that God made an error and he needs to change things. Which then gives rise to...
Can't hear you. Lost audio. Can't hear you.
Can you hear me?
Now we can.
Okay, I can't hear you. So just don't say anything. We'll be fine. Say something, Mark.
Hello, we can hear you.
Yeah, I can't hear you. Okay, I'm going to have to figure out an alternative to this. Either way, it is astonishing that God then, having admitted that he makes mistakes, he goes to wipe out the entirety of humankind, which raises the question of what on earth they did wrong. What possibly happened? And I don't know how many of you have saw Russell Crowe's version of Noah. Anybody see that? It came out about 5-6 years ago. Maybe it was longer than that. I'm about to transition my audio equipment, so forgive me.
We don't hear you.
Now?
Now we do.
Okay. His lips have to be moving, Linda.
All right. There we go. Well, I don't know what's going on. We'll figure it out. Okay. Great technical difficulties. That's what we need. I knew the debate was muting microphones. I didn't know they had this kind of reach. It's unbelievable. Okay. So somebody say something. Mark?
Hello. We can hear you.
All right. Forget it. Forget it. I'm going to just open up my machine. You can hear me now?
Yes.
I can hear you. We're going to do it this way. Miriam's teaching in the other room. Can you hear her?
No.
Excellent. Because she's doing color classes, and I'm not sure we all want to hear that broadcast right now. Okay, so let's begin with the parsha. Last year, as I said, was the first parsha under pressure. I did parsha Noach, and we began by noting that there were three times the name Noach is repeated in the opening verse. And it's an impressive debut as a biography. Noach is told, what's the opening pasuk of the parsha? Anybody know? Anyone laying it? Wonderful. It's incredibly repetitive. Ela toldot Noach. These are the generations of Noach. At that point, you could just say, Hayat Sadiq says, Noach, ish Sadiq, tamim haya b'doratav. He was a man that was righteous, perfect in his age. So we noted last year, we actually, I had quite an ambitious pair of source sheets. We only got through this first observation that Noah's name appears three times in the opening pasuk. Why on earth it does that? It's completely unnecessary. And there are a number of readings. One reading we noted, the Bala Turim suggests that Noah went through a transition and he lived in three different worlds. It says, in this opening description of his personality, we are given an insinuation of the transitions that he goes through. He has pre-flood Noah, post-flood Noah, and during flood Noah. So there is an understanding that he is not the same person. He's changed by what he sees. Now, he's described as Ish Tzadik, a righteous man. Does that sound like a good or bad description?
Good.
Yeah, I take it. Tamim, he's perfect. Not only is he righteous, he's perfect. Tamim. What is Tamim, by the way? Anyone familiar? The word Tam.
Complete.
So it means complete. Does it have other connotations?
Simple.
Yeah, when do we use it in that context?
Pesach.
Four sons.
Pesach, we have the four sons. We've got the Chacham, the Rasha, the Tam. And when we say Tam, we don't mean perfect, right? Otherwise, I assume they'd be better than the Chacham. There is an assumption that there is something innocent and pure when you're simple. And Tamim has that sense of simplicity. As well. So he was Ish Tzadik, he was righteous, and Tamim, he was whole. And in many ways, what we'll see, not only was he whole, he was naive. He was naive. Avraham seems to be a worldly figure who understands that there's good and evil, and he needs to fight even for those who are corrupt. Noach, he just does what he's told. He's entirely passive. He has this innocence about him. In the same way, who else is described as Tam in Bereshit?
Yaakov.
Yaakov. When is Yaakov described as Tam?
Yaakov ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim.
As a young man. As a young man, Esav is out in the fields and Yaakov is in ish Tam. And again, that's usually read, he's a perfect man. But what does Yaakov go on to do? We'll get to this when we get to Parshat Toldot, Bereshit Chav Zayin. He does something also almost unconscionable to his brother.
He thieves
his brother's birthright. And why does he do it? Does he sit and scheme and plot and plan and think, I need to get hold of my brother's birthright? Why does he do it?
He wants the bracha.
Listening to his mother.
Mother told him to.
Right. As all good Jewish boys do, he did what his mother told him to. Rivka really is the driving force of that entire scheme. Which I guess when we get to Toldot, we can talk about why is she scheming? Why didn't she have a conversation with her husband? What are they trying to do? Is it plausible that Yitzchak wouldn't have recognized his own son? He even admits this is the voice of Jacob. He doesn't get that suspicious. But it's that description of Tam, that he's innocent, meaning he's pushed around. His mother tells him what to do and he does it. And here, Noach is Tamim. And God tells him to build a boat while he's going to wipe out humanity. And what does Noah say?
Okay.
He doesn't even say okay, right? He just does it. Noah's entirely passive. There's this naivete that perfection involves passivity, that we just do what we're told instead of taking a stand, which is a moral code that emerges over time from Abraham onward. So we've got this figure, and it seems, at least on its face, though, that it's a positive description. He's Ich Tzadik Tamim Hayaba Doratav. He was perfect in his age. Now, this is probably the most well-known ambiguity, at least in this parasha. What's ambiguous about the description that Noach was perfect in his age?
In his generation, but not in others.
Right. There is a whole-scale debate in the sages about whether this is praise or whether this is prejudicious. They were saying Noach was Ish Tzadik. He was a good man. Tamim Haya. He was perfect Bedoratav in his age. And there are some sages, again, and when I introduced this last year, I didn't do an overall survey. Oh, I forgot to do a survey of the parasha. I guess we'll do that in a minute. There we go. Do that in a minute. But at least here's the survey. Flood, Noah survives, big tower, they get scattered. End of parasha. There are some details in the middle. There are a couple of birds, a rainbow, some wine, some embarrassing towel situation. There's a lot of details along the way. We can get to more detail. Either way, Noah is given this description where he's in his age described as great. And there is, as I say, a wholesale debate among the sages about whether this is good or bad. And if we put that bit of the pasuk under pressure, which was last year's pasuk, we have to wonder why it says he was great in his age. Just say, Ha'ish tzadik hayatamim. He was a righteous man. He was perfect. Or he was simple. He was pure. He was innocent. What is this Bedoratav in his age? Again, if I were writing a piece of oratory, of course I would say that. This was the greatest man in his age, in any place that anyone ever lived. But the Torah is very, very concise, very terse, at least through the eyes of the Malbim and others. You have to imagine that every word is chosen sparingly. So he is great in his age. One reading of that is he was great in his age, as Mark and Linda said. He was great in his age, but he wouldn't have been so great in another age. Rashi says if he were to live in the age of Abraham, he would have been a no one. He got lucky. He lived in an age where he was surrounded by brutes and barbarians. So Noach tamim haya b'doratav. He was good, relatively speaking. That's one reading, which is pretty derogatory. Noah was okay, is what it comes down to. The alternative reading is that Noah wasn't just okay. Even in his age, he was great. And the suggestion there on the part of those sages is, in a world of brutes and barbarity, it actually, it's harder to be good. You're surrounded by the pressures of peers who want to lead you astray, and you've made the choice, the conscious choice, to go against the grain. Tamim Hayaba Doratav, he was great even in his age. Abraham, in some ways, had it easy. He could walk away. He could live a life on his own in isolation with his own convictions and his own ethics. Noah was surrounded by brutality, and yet he was an Ish Tzadik Tamim. So it's seen as praise and derogatory at the same time, and we can openly have a debate about that. Now, we're told what went wrong. Humanity filled the world with what? V'ha'aretz mele'ah, and the world was filled with?
Hamas,
which I guess we don't have to get political. I think, what does Hamas translate as? Anybody know?
Destruction.
Like violence or vice. It has a gory, destructive connotation to it. I'm pretty sure that the political terrorist organization Hamas has a different root and does not mean violence and vile, however much it may be appropriate. So we're told that Eretz Melea Hamas, the world was filled with vice and violence. And the question then becomes, why not just say there was violence? What is meant by the world is filled with vice? Again, putting pressure on that terminology. And I'll just share this, an interesting view found also in the Baal HaTurim, who suggests that literally Haaretz, the land, Melea Hamas was filled with vice. And he gives this purported suggestion that people would go to their friends and deposit their jewels with them and say, could you watch my jewels for me? And they say, of course, you can deposit it. I'll look after it. And then what would the people do? They didn't have safe houses. They didn't have banks with safety deposit boxes. They would bury it with their own treasure in their own home. And the friends would lace their jewels with perfume and give it, deposit it with their neighbor. So when the neighbor buried it, they would follow the scent of the perfume, find their own jewels, and then steal their neighbor's jewels as well. And it's a very strange narrative to depict. But what's being suggested here is that Ha'aretz Melea Hamas, the very earth, was infested with vice. The extent to which people had become brutal and unjust was that they would steal even from their own friends. And they wouldn't just steal, they would exploit and take advantage of others' kindness. There were people who would do them favors, and people had zero sense of gratitude or loyalty to their friends. A horrific time. Now, Noach is told to build an ark, and he says, okay, I'll build an ark. And this is the pressure, the pasuk I want to put under pressure. I'm going to share my screen with you so that we can talk about a particular redundancy. Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Excellent. So, anyone know who that is? Russell Crowe. If we don't know who that is, we're in trouble. That's Noach. It's just a painting. So, this is the pasuk I would like to put under pressure. Aselecha tevat atzei gopher. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. Anyone know what gopher wood is? Anyone know what gopher wood is?
Cedar.
Yeah. So the fact that we don't know what it is tells you or makes you ask what question?
Why particularly gopher?
Yeah. Why do I care? Again, if we're putting pressure on psukim and we want to excise extra words because we need precision from God, why is he telling, why are we being told what wood Noah was used, what he was told to use? Let me ask you a question. How many nails are we told that Noah used to build the ark?
None.
He didn't use any nails?
Not told.
Not told.
We're not told. Right. How many planks of wood?
Not told.
Ditto.
What was his bedding made of?
No idea.
Most likely straw, but we're not told.
Most likely straw. Right, meaning we could intuit if God said, make for yourself an ark of wood, we'd say, okay, it was probably a kind of wood. You need to know. I'd say gopher is a kind of gopher wood. It's very strange. And again, here we have a broad range of commentators who suggest that there is a message here in the gopher wood. You've got some of the more what we call shut-oriented rational commentators suggest actually he used gopher wood because it floats. Some woods are better at floating than others, meaning cork floats pretty well. Oak probably doesn't. I've no idea. They probably make big Navy ships out of oak when they polish it and stuff. But back in the day, it wasn't that versatile. But that's really a superficial reading that doesn't tell us why we need to know what he used, unless it's guidance for us 200 years later, 2000 years later, how to build boats. So there is a view that actually God had made a decree to wipe the world out, humankind. Last week, at the end of the parasha, God didn't say, I'm going to kill everybody apart from Noah. God said, I regret the fact that I made humankind. Broad, whole-scale destruction. So the insinuation of the commentators is that God had to somehow repeal his decree to save Noah. How could he save Noah, having given this universal declaration of destruction? So he had, the decree was gafrit ve'esh, that he would use a flood with sulfur, gafrit. So he tells Noah to use atzei gopher, so he'll be surrounded by something gopher, which is what ash evolves from. So that he would also be included in the decree and somehow God wouldn't break his word. That's one reading. The Malbim, however, has a fascinating reading as to why we use gopher wood. But you know what? I overdo the Malbim. So we're going to save that for another time. Because there's a different part of that pasuk that I want to put under pressure that on its face doesn't seem that significant. But in fact, it's highly profound. Noach is told, build this ark from gopher wood. From everything living, from every flesh, you shall bring onto the ark. What don't we need to be told? What seems redundant or excessive in that description?
Mikol basar.
Mikol basar, right? Atzei lecha tevat atzei gopher. Make for yourself a ark of wood. Mikol achai tavi ala tevan. From everything living, bring onto the ark. What do I need to be told? Mikol basar and all basar.
Could be plants.
Leave out the fish.
Say, don't bring the fish. Right. Interesting. So Mikol HaChai, say that again, Linda. You think that Mikol HaChai would include only plants? Oh, so you're saying this is a clarification. This is to stop Noah building a one of those big greenhouses. So then I guess he could have said, Askel HaTavdat say go for Mikol Basar Tavila Teva, from all the animals bring onto the ark. What is this doubling of language, Mikol HaChai? And I guess Linda's right. He wasn't bringing every living being, and he didn't bring fish, he didn't bring plants, he didn't bring algae, he didn't bring all sorts of microbes. Why not just say Mikol Basar? Mikol HaChai seemed redundant. And just before we get into some of the reading of why it states both, the Ramban asks an interesting question, which I think it's worth reading. He says, Yadua, it is well known, this is Nachmanides writing in the 13th century, Ki achayut rabot ma'ot, that there are many animals, and he's living in an age where you can't walk to the Bronx Zoo or the Queen Zoo, but he knows there are hundreds and thousands of species, mehen gedolot ma'ot, and some animals are insy-wincy, you have little bugs, and some animals are not insy-wincy. For example, kapilim, like elephants. Re'imim. What are re'imim? Yeah, re'imim's complicated. This is more of a legendary animal. Sometimes it's used to describe a vast, colossal unicorn, some sign of oxen. The Midrash describes Noah bringing a re'im on, which almost dragged the boat down. So he's saying, but there are big animals, like elephants and oxen and giraffe.
Ibex.
Tigers.
Say again?
Ram is an ibex.
An ibex?
Yeah.
What is an ibex?
It's like a deer with the horns.
Oh, like an ibex?
Ibex, ibex.
Ibex.
Yeah. Ibex. Okay. So Ra'im has been translated differently over time. If you go to the Biblical Zoo in Jerusalem now, I think they will identify Ra'im with a ibex. But ibex has other names too, and sometimes it means kind of a grand bull. Either way, it's a big animal. Vizulatam. Now, Ramban's question is, I asked you how many nails were used. I asked you what Noah's bedding was made out of, which, of course, were ridiculous. We're not told. Anyone know how long the ark was?
150 cubits.
Right. We're told how big the ark was. You can physically measure out. It's 300 by 150 by 50. You can sit down, measure that out, right? It is not huge. It is probably the same volume as our main sanctuary. Roughly speaking, you try and fit every species of animal in our main sanctuary, even without social distancing. I know before Corona, we may have felt that we had every species of animal crowded in there, but I don't think we did. You can try and fit in elephants and lions and tigers and bears and re'imim and leopard. It's impossible. How can you
three levels?
Three levels. That's true. I have a nice video of my daughter Ariella earlier building a magnetile ark describing what was on three levels. But even with three levels, what was on the bottom level? Anybody know?
DNA samples.
DNA samples. Yes, that was the Steven Spielberg version. We don't know what was on all levels. The Midrash suggests the bottom level was garbage. The middle level, I should say rubbish, but Ariella said garbage, so we'll go with garbage. The middle level was animals, and the top level, she said, was people and fruits and vegetables. I don't know if that was her Chabad, that they were trying to be healthy, or they just didn't want to be mean to the animals underneath, because Noah wasn't allowed to eat meat yet, but it was fruits and vegetables. I assume there were bean sprouts too. But here's the Ramban's question. There are an immense number of animals. They are huge, some of them. From the birds and the creatures, ein lahem mispar, beyond number, ka'asher te'asof, and since they were gathered, l'chulam ma'achal, and you had to get food for them, asher yochal l'shanat mima, that they could eat for a whole year. They didn't know how long they were being on, so you're going to pack up this ark, as you say, three levels. One is packed full of food. The others are packed full of animals. We know how big. How do you fit this? It just does. It stretches the imagination. And again, of course, the whole idea stretches the imagination that the world was flooded and the animals came. But there are concrete details. So at least be consistent. Why does the Torah give us a measurement that couldn't possibly hold these animals if it tried? Lo tachil otam ha-teva hazor, it wouldn't work. Ve lo eser ke-yotzeh ba. Even if it were 10 times as large, Nachman, he says it wouldn't fit. So what's his answer? Aval hu nes hechzik mu'at et ha-murba. It was a miracle that God fit all these animals inside. Wonderful. Ramban's not happy with that ending, though, because what's Ramban's follow-up question? This is his follow-up question. He says, hold on a minute. God could not possibly fit all these animals in an ark that size without a miracle. So if you are God and you're going to do a miracle to squeeze all these animals in, what's the easiest thing to do?
Make the ark bigger.
Okay, make the ark bigger. Well, who's building the ark?
Noah.
So that probably would be harder. Let's say you're thinking about your labor costs and you want to make this easier. What are you going to do?
Make the animals.
Yeah, I think what I would do is I'd say, Noah, go grab an etrog box, open it up, bring all the animals, which I should probably deal with this some point soon. When they come up and they say, we're not going to fit, say, trust me, just walk in, stick him in this box, tighten up, 40 days later, you walk on out. Meaning Ramban saying God had to condense the animals anyway. God was miraculously making them fit anyway. So why not make it easy on Noah and get a matchbox and get them all walking in? That's Ramban's question. And I know this sounds almost ludicrous, but to compute the information that we're giving, you have to make some of these leaps. And Ramban has some fascinating answers. He gives two answers as to why God made a miracle to fit the animals in, but not too much of a miracle. What would you suggest? Why would God not make it so small? What interest does God have in Noah building an ark, even though he's going to have to do a miracle anyway to fit everything in? Say again, Esther.
Wanted the people around him to see him building it.
Excellent. So you've been hanging out with Nachmanides. One of his answers is that the interest here, Noah wasn't building out of celestial sadism. God had a purpose in Noah exhibiting this building project, which tradition tells us took decades and decades to build, because he wanted humanity to see the threat that was looming. So that's certainly that's one option he gives. And he gives one more option. Somebody else said something I didn't hear. And was it the same thing? So the second answer that the Ramban gives is that in life, we can expect miracles, but we have to work. Even if nobody saw Noah, even if nobody would have seen Noah, even if Noah did this in the quiet of night, away from human eyes, it would have been worth Noah's time to build an ark, even though miracles would be performed, because God wants us to exert effort, to toil in life, not just to earn our miracles because he's testing us, but because meaningful life involves making an effort, having pride over what we do. When Noah walked around that ark and fed those animals and saw his family survive, he felt like he had a measure of control over his destiny, because he had put labor in, he put work in. He could see the boards and the nails made of gopher and metal that he nailed together to save the people. So the Ramban presumes that there is a value, there is a virtue in labor, even if a miracle would be performed at the end of the day. And Noah understood that. He didn't say just make a matchbox. He understood that work had value. So that's the Ramban's opening point. So let's continue. Those are his two answers. But we still haven't addressed the question of why we're told mikol ha-chayim, mikol basar, from every living being and every flesh. The Malbim does have an answer. I'm not going to read it inside. And he's got an interesting answer where he says there are two characteristics of creatures, human creatures, mammalian creatures, reptilian creatures. There are our aesthetic features and our essential features, the way we look and the way we behave. And there are some creatures that look pretty similar but behave quite differently. Human beings and monkeys don't look that distinct. Of course,
lost you.
You froze.
No sound.
Not here.
Was it us or him? That's my problem.
Is he hosting tonight, Mark?
Say that again, Harold.
Is the rabbi hosting? He's in charge?
He's in charge.
Oh, hello, I am not in charge. I have no control over anything.
We hear you now.
He's back.
I don't know what happened. My Zoom just shut down and then restarted. How much did you miss?
Okay. Start again with the Malbim.
Okay, I think we'll just start again from the beginning. So we've only got 8 minutes. So what we'll do, we'll leave Malbim aside because he gives a fascinating notion. All right, well, I'll mention what he says. He's in the Kol HaChayim Kol Basar. Noah may have thought, I'll just get everything that looks distinct on the ark, but if things behave differently, I'll leave it off. And or he might have said, I'll get all the behavioral differences, but who cares about aesthetic diversity? And what the Malbim suggests here is when God says, Mekol HaChayim Mekol Basari, God is suggesting diversity is essential to creation, whether it is behavioral diversity or aesthetic diversity. We need the panoply, as we have there, Harry, with the beautiful colors. You need to have a panoply of aesthetic diversity, but you also need behavioral differences in order to live in a healthy way. And we'll get to that actually in our political discussion on Monday night, either this week or the week after, in terms of democratic tendencies, that actually diversity is a strength and helpful, and how that plays out in Jewish thought. We'll speak to that on Monday. That's the Malbim on why he's told to bring the Kol HaChayim Mekol Basar. But I do want to finish with an astonishing Rashi.
Rabbi, what you were saying, the question that I had for the longest time is, why was the snake included on the Teva, given what he did in Gan Eden and given his evil inclinations and everything negative about the snake? But what you're saying now, in a sense, includes not just the diversity, that even those animals that may seem predatory and negative and horrible were still included because they were still God's creations.
That, I have to say, was not planted, but is an excellent segue to what I was about to say from Rashi. Because Rashi says, Mekol HaChayim Mekol Basar, bring every living thing, every creature. Rashi has two words that he says. He doesn't say the snake. He says two words. Afilu Shadim. Even Shadim. Anyone know what Shadim are?
Demons.
I spoke about this, I think, last year, Rosh Hashanah, between Minch and Maariv. In high school, one of my teachers was a kind of pseudo-Kabbalist, and he would get angry if we said the word Shadim. He says, don't say that! It attracts them. You have to call them Shin Dalim. So we weren't allowed to say Shadim. And what else weren't we allowed to do because it would attract Shadim? No whistling. It could be he just hated whistling. But he said, don't whistle and don't say Shadim because it attracts them. I know I've said it like 5 times now. If I do shut down Zoom again, you just assume that was one of the Shadim. So we can have a long discussion about whether Shadim are real, invented, legendary, foreign influence. There are views. The Rambam Maimonides says the whole thing is a Persian influence. When the rabbis were writing, they included it kind of culturally, but it's nonsense. The Rambam has nothing to do with Shadim. But they do appear in rabbinic discussions in all sorts of cases where they presume that Shadim, demons, demonic figures, are real. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, the brother of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, suggested, he was scientific in his training, he suggested that really this recognition of these demonic creatures was a recognition of bacteria, that there are unseen, invisible forces that can invade our system, which is an intriguing option. There is a slight problem, because the rabbis talk about a case where somebody, you hear a voice, somebody shouts out, write a get for my wife. And then this is a Gemara in Gittin. Gemara says, should we write it, assuming that the husband appointed us? What happens if a shade shouted it out? So I assume no bacteria are going to get together and say, write a get for my wife. No one's going to be fooled by bacteria shouting. So there is an assumption culturally that they're real. Either way, what's important for us, Rashi is saying, Noach is being told, as Chavi suggested, Kol HaChai Mikol Basar, don't just bring the lions and the tigers, the king of the jungle, don't just bring the animals that seem to be positively impacting the world. Bring Afilu Shadim, even the demons. Bring even the demons. And Chavi's suggestion as to why Noach is told to bring even the demons is intriguing, saying that they're creatures too. And we have to have some sort of compassion on creatures, whether they're good or evil. And I guess that point could be debated. There is one view suggested by Emmanuel Levinas, a French Jewish philosopher, who I'm going to share my screen again, although I'm concerned that it may ruin Zoom. This is Rashi, where he says, Noach is told, Mikol Achai afilu shedim. And this is the way Emmanuel Levinas reads it. He says, these are the tempters of post-diluvian civilization. Post-diluvian means after the flood. These are the tempters, these demons that Noach is told to bring on board, are the tempters of civilization after the flood, without which, no doubt, mankind of the future could not be, despite its regeneration, the true mankind. And what Emmanuel Levinas is suggesting here is that Noach, this is the perfect opportunity. God is starting from scratch. He is wiping the world of vice away. And he could turn to Noach and say, bring on the animals, shut out the demons. I want you to live in a perfect utopia without temptation, without allure, without sin. And Rashi suggests, afilu shedim, he is told, bring on the demons. Because even though I'm remaking the world, even though I'm wiping away the volume of vice that became intolerable, humanity needs temptation in order to really be humanity. I don't want a race of angels. I don't want a utopia on earth. I've got a utopia up here in heaven. I want a sphere of activity where there is good and evil, in a world where human beings are called to triumph in a war of good over evil. And you need to take those shedim with you, because without them, there's no challenge. There's nothing to achieve. It's just robotic angels performing ritual for my pleasure. So this is quite telling again. After we have Adam and Eve expelled from Eden, humanity wiped out for their evil, we now have God insisting that demons come on the ark, so that when Noach emerges, we still have impulses and temptations and allure and distractions that we are bid to overcome. And we should not see those flaws as scars from Adam or Eve's sin, but as gifts from God for us to rise over, to assist each other and reach out and aim to perfect ourselves. It is 8:59. I know that you've all got queued up on YouTube or on the televisions for the event that's going to shape most probably absolutely nothing, but will entertain, no doubt. So I want to bid you all a Shabbat Shalom. There was a sponsor this evening. I don't have it in front of me. Please forgive me. Leah, you're sponsoring this evening. So Leah, I want to recognize the sponsorship, and it's in memory of, you're muted, I'm sorry.
Sorry, my father.
Memory of my your father. I want to wish you
Israel ben Yosef Mordechai.
Israel ben Yosef Mordechai.
Israel ben Yosef Mordechai.
Israel ben Yosef Mordechai. I want to wish your father's neshama and aliyah. Our learning should be in his memory. His memory should serve us all as a blessing. And I want to wish you a chayim aruchim, a long life. Which I just, as I say that, I realize it's a British turn of phrase. I remember when I first moved to the States, I went to a shiva and I wished somebody long life. And they looked at me like I was saying the most offensive thing in the world. They looked at me and they said, I'm not that old. No, when I wish you a long life, I'm not saying you don't have much left. It's just something we say in England. So I wish you a chayim aruchim, the neshama should have an aliyah. Thank you for your sponsorship. Thank you. And I want to wish you all a Shabbat Shalom. And please, God, we'll see you over Shabbat. And I do intend, hopefully, to send out a drasha on Motzei Shabbat again. It's not yet written, so that's not a guarantee. But I'm hoping. So I want to wish you all well.
Rabbi Lerner, good evening.
Good evening.
Can I ask you a question regarding back to Tamim?
Yes.
It says that Noach was Tamim, but in Parshat Lech Lecha, and Parak Yud Zion says that quote the pasuk says Vayi Avraham ben Tishin Shana v'Teisha Shanim Vayera Hashem El Avraham Vayom Elav Ani Kel Shaddai V'Zalech Lufanai V'Hayei Tamim. Rashi quotes this, says that you're not Tamim because you weren't circumcised yet. Does this imply that that Noach was circumcised?
Very interesting. So I guess you'd have to ask that question to Rashi. There is a Jewish tradition that some of our great figures were born circumcised, that Moshe was born circumcised. I'm not aware of that tradition with Noach. The word tamim is used in different ways. We're commanded to be tamim. In Dvarim, in Parashat Shoftim, we're told, Hitalech lefanai tamim, walk before God in purity. That's clearly not the same command as to have a Brit Milah, which is given in Parashat Lech Lecha. So I guess we'd have to put that question to Rashi as to why he feels that that's what Hashem's referring to there, where Tamim has a lot of applications elsewhere. But it is a very interesting question. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Have a good Shabbos.
You too. Good Shabbos, everybody.
Good Shabbos.
Thank you. Good job.
Thank you.
Good night, Rachel. Good night, everybody. Thank you all.
Good Shabbos.
Good Shabbos. Keep well. Jerry and Debbie, you're in the same place?
No. Just a little apart.
How far? Like a room or different?
About 6 feet.
All right. Well, say hello to each other for me.
Okay.
Hello.
Say hi to Miriam.
Oh, will do. With pleasure.
Okay. Shabbat shalom.
Good to see you. Shabbat
Can
shalom.
Can we tune into the Kala class now?
I'm about to go two in because I'm sure there's some things I need to learn. I'm going to figure it out.
Let us know.
Good Shabbos.
Good Shabbos.
I'll keep you posted. Good Shabbos. Good Shabbos. Thanks, Leah. Good Shabbos to you. Good Shabbos.